In for the news, read by Jane Royce.
The first service in a new era of rail nationalisation ran this morning. Southwestern became the first operator to be brought back into public ownership under Labour as part of plans to renationalise and rebrand most of the network in England. Four other major operators, including LNER and Northern, had already been brought under public ownership by previous Conservative governments. Richard Bowker is the former chairman of the Strategic Rail Authority, which used to oversee the network.
The really profound thing about this change is it's bringing together track and train. The network has got much more complex to run in those 30 years. And by bringing it together under a single unified management team, which I think with most people would say is the sensible thing to do, that has the potential to make things better.
The Deputy Prime Minister, Angela Rayner, has said she can't guarantee that changes to the government's policy on the winter fuel allowance will be in place in time for this winter. Sir Keir Starmer signalled he wants more people to get the payment, which was scrapped last year for all except the poorest pensioners. The leader of the Conservatives, Kemi Badenoch, said the payments should be restored immediately, though not for the very richest pensioners. Angela Rayner's also insisted the government is 100% behind the Chancellor after a leaked memo which emerged last week highlighted a disagreement between the two over the country's finances. Ms Rayner denied being behind the leak. Russia's carried out its largest overnight air attack on Ukraine so far, killing at least 12 people, including three children, according to Ukrainian officials. Both sides have today completed the final stage of a large prisoner swap, each exchanging 1,000 prisoners over the past 3 days. House builders who leave development sites in England unfinished for too long could see their land handed over to local councils under new government rules. For the first time, developers will also have to commit to delivery timeframes before being granted planning permission. Gary Lineker will present Match of the Day for the final time tonight. He'll leave the BBC earlier than planned after sharing a post on social media considered to be anti-Semitic. He's since apologised and said he never meant to share anything offensive. And the weather showery across Scotland and Northern Ireland this afternoon, but drier in England and Wales, particularly in the south there. It'll be generally windy with a mix of patchy cloud and sunny intervals. BBC News at 2 minutes past 12. Now, Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
The comedian, writer and podcaster Adam Buxton first burst onto our television screens 30 years ago. He and his friend Joe Cornish created The Adam and Joe Show, which featured pranks, songs and reenactments of famous films like Titanic, Trainspotting, using their childhood stuffed toys, along with work on radio and film, an eye for the weird and wonderful quirks of music videos, and a multi-award-winning interview podcast. He's also written two memoirs. The first, Ramble Book, included a very poignant account of his father's final months when he lived with Adam and his family until his death at the age of 91. More recently, his book, I Love You, Bye, includes reflections on losing his mother, as he says, to death. We didn't get separated in a shop. And both books include plenty of musings on growing up and his many personal obsessions. Ravel, Grieg, Thelonious, Monk today. But you're going to begin with something we don't often have, a composer we don't often have, Sir Arthur Bliss.
Yeah, I only found out that he was the composer of this piece before doing this show. As far as I was aware, this was Jeff Love and his orchestra yeah. creating this amazing noise, which I first heard when my mum bought me a tape of sci-fi themes.
Well, Sir Arthur Bliss was actually a very fine composer. He wrote a very successful ballet, Checkmate, and was master of the Queen's music for a while. And he did do some film scores, which clearly how you came across this.
That's right. I've only seen a little bit of the film that this was the theme for, which is Things to Come by H.G. Wells, and it's very stagey and stiff, but it was a huge deal when it came out in 1936 because it was predicting essentially another world war. Mm. That's obviously what happened, but the war that the film depicts goes on for like 30 years or something and transforms the whole world and ends up with this utopian society being born at the other end of it. Lots of weird echoes of things that are happening in the modern world, kind of populist leaders rising up out of the chaos. Anyway, I wasn't aware of any of that when I first heard this music. I just was completely overwhelmed by how exciting it was and how stirring it was. I always remember my dad talking about going off to the Second World War, and I asked him, like, weren't you frightened? Because that's all I can think of is how terrifying it would be to go to war. And my dad said, no, I mean, we didn't have any conception of what it would be like. No realistic conception of what was in store for us. And he was D-Day plus three or something, and he was an artillery sergeant. But as far as he was concerned, as a man in his early 20s, he was going to have a lark. It was going to be exciting. He was going to be with his pals sorting the world out.
Reality found something very different.
Yeah, exactly. But in a way, this piece of music has all that in it. Deal with that.
We heard The March from Things to Come, written by Sir Arthur Bliss and performed by Jeff Love and his orchestra. Let's talk a little bit more about your early life, Adam Buxton. You were born in London.
Yes.
And you mentioned your dad, but later on he was travel editor on the Sunday Telegraph.
Yes, that's right. He went off to Oxford after the war as a sort of older undergraduate and met lots of people he was very impressed by there. Like, he was pals with John le Carré and a newsreader called Reggie Bosanquet, who was a big celeb at the time. And for a while, he shared a flat with Reggie. And my dad found himself in this exciting world of establishment superstars, as he saw them, having been born into a family of servants who worked on an estate in Sussex. And thanks to the patronage of the people that my dad's parents worked for, he got all these opportunities to be educated in a way that was quite unusual for someone from his background. He was a good writer, though, writing for the Telegraph for many years. And that was amazing for us as well, because we got to travel the world with him.
And your mum, Valerie?
Yeah, well, she met Dad because she was also in the travel industry, although she was a stewardess. She met Dad on a BOAC flight in the early 60s, and she would always joke, "Oh," I said, "coffee, tea or me?" That was Mum's bit of bants about how she met Dad. But Dad was taken by her. She's South American from Chile and very glamorous woman. And, you know, they were the supermodels of the day back then, the flight attendants. Mm. So that's how they met. And, yeah, we came along a few years after.
Was music a big part of family life?
I mean, it was to a degree, but they had very different tastes. Well, certainly my dad. He liked Wagner. He just thought that was the absolute best. The lightest he ever got was Glenn Miller. I liked that too, actually. I liked In the Mood and things like that. Mum was 15 years younger than my dad, so she was more into pop music. She liked the Beatles. And she got into all the stuff that I liked. We'd listen to the charts in the car. I knew every single song in the top 40 for about 2 years, around 1980, 81. And as far as I was concerned, everything was good. It was all brilliant. I loved it. My dad hated every single thing in that top 40 and beyond. He thought it was evidence of the end of worthwhile civilization. He just didn't see the use in it at all. It was too simple for him. He didn't like what he called the ugliness, not much discernible technical quality in the vocals, things like, he couldn't get beyond that. He never stopped giving me a hard time for loving that music.
Did you get to learn an instrument at all, Adam?
I never got to learn an instrument, and I really regret it. I mean, it was never offered up as an option that I can remember, but I'm sure if it had been, I would have balked at the amount of work involved, all the practicing. I never really did anything like that. I was industrious in some ways, but only if it was stuff that I wanted to do. I liked art and drawing, and I worked hard at those things. But actual study, the study involved in mastering an instrument, I just never had that in my locker.
So would you describe yourself as having been slightly introspective, or were you an outgoing child?
I think I was a bit of both, really. I was very gregarious. I liked being silly and showing off a little bit, I suppose, and making people laugh when I could. But I was a massive worrier. I worried about absolutely everything.
Reading your book, you still do.
Yeah. Total. Oh, massive overthinker and worrier. And it took me ages to kind of realise that that's what I was like. I always thought of myself as quite upbeat, fun and straightforward. But when I got more towards middle age and people started dying and you become even more introspective, and maybe it's writing memoirs. I wouldn't recommend writing a memoir.
So how did you cope in that case with boarding school aged 9?
Initially, it was a total disaster. It was like the worst thing I could possibly imagine happening. And my parents suddenly sprung it on me at the end of 1978. They said, "Oh, yeah, in January, you're going to go off to boarding school." And they had to explain to me what it was. It's a school, but you live there. I was like, "Oh, right, you mean like the worst thing that I could possibly imagine." You live at school. And what, you never come home? You sleep at school? I was like, "You're joking, aren't you?" And I was traumatised by it. You know, I would phone up my mum from the payphone there, trying to jam 10p pieces into this amazingly stiff slot. And then every now and again, I'd run out of money, get cut off, and I'd be midway through wailing at my mum and saying, why can't I come home? And I said to her years later, you know, was it not sad for you as a mother of a 9-year-old boy to have a phone call like that? She said, yes, it was awful. It was the worst feeling in the world. And I said, well, why did you send me there then? She said, because we thought it would be good for you, toughen you up a little bit. And also it was what their friends were doing with their children.
Grieg next.
Grieg is one of the people that was introduced to me by my son. My wife has been brilliant at forcing the children to have music lessons. And there were many tantrums and falling outs because of it. But actually, it's meant that they're not intimidated by learning an instrument. And in fact, my middle son, Natty, taught himself how to play piano from watching YouTube videos. And now he's quite good. I just love this piece of music. And the happiest I get is coming home and finding that he's on the piano playing this.
Notorno from Grieg's Lyric Pieces, played by Emil Gilels.
It's one of the best bits of being a dad, actually, is seeing one of my children being able to play that, because playing an instrument just seems such a magical thing still.
And it must be quite fascinating for somebody who didn't hear a lot of classical music to actually be introduced to things by your child.
Yeah, exactly. I like the brevity of some of the Grieg stuff, and I know that he was known for his short piano works. And he himself, I found out, was unusually short in stature. And I also am a short man. So I think I've got an affinity for any other. I like all short men. Maybe not Napoleon, I don't know. But
was it Monty Python where they described it as vertically challenged?
There you go, exactly.
And you're not that short. Adam Buxton, aged 14, you met your friend Joe Cornish. What were your first impressions? Was he short too?
No, he's a tall man. I think I'm attracted to tall people. My wife is tall. At school, my best friends were Joe Cornish and Louis Theroux as well, who's another tall man. What does it say about me? I like looking up. I like... I mean, tall people do have an easier go of things, it seems to me, in the world. People in positions of power tend to be tall. Anyway, listen, clearly I'm hung up on the whole subject and I need to talk to my therapist.
Just for an hour or so, you've got free therapy here.
Okay,
through music.
All right, thank you.
So you made short films.
Yes, yeah, more shortness. We made short films. Joe was always obsessed with film, and he had it in his head as a tall, haughty person that he was going to make films. Another thing that seemed completely unimaginably magical to me, I just thought, people like us don't make films. Other people make films the same way that other people make music. So it was wonderful to have friends like Joe who were always completely convinced that one day they would make films, and so it turned out. Joe made a film called Attack the Block and then The Kid Who Would Be King, and has worked on many other films since. But we made stuff at school that was quite silly. Well, actually, Joe did one that was semi-serious. It was like a remake of the Sweeney Todd story. I played a hard-bitten detective called Donovan Spanner, and I kind of did a David Bowie impression to sort of play Donovan Spanner as this tough detective. Louis Theroux played my hapless sidekick, Harvey, and we were ridiculed, I remember, by a lot of the other children who found us quite insufferable. One of them passed around this scandal rag gossip sheet, you know, pre-social media. What they did was write a lot of scurril down and mean-spirited conjecture about people and then photocopy it and pass it round. And we occupied one of the paragraphs and they referred to us as insufferable thesps or something and ridiculed Joe and said he seems to think that Steven Spielberg will whisk him off to Hollywood on his magic carpet. And that's exactly what happened. So I was happy about that.
You ended up studying sculpture at art school.
Well, I ended up doing sculpture, but only because it was a course that I could get into, Cheltenham and Gloucester College of Higher Education. You didn't have to hack away at blocks of wood and marble. You could really do anything you wanted.
Your interest in David Bowie, led you really to Brian Eno, didn't it?
Yes, that's right. Well, one of the great things about being a Bowie fan was all the stuff that you would discover in the journey through all his albums. And I had a book called An Illustrated Record that I adored and pored over. And that introduced me to loads of the people that he'd worked with. Lou Reed, The Velvet Underground, and of course, Brian Eno.
So which number have you chosen?
It's called The Pearl. Came out in 1984 that he did with Harold Budd, an American composer. And when you listen to it with headphones, I loved how it zipped from one ear to the other and everything about this.
The Pearl by Harold Budd and Brian Eno. Curiously enough, I was somehow connected to the Grieg by that piece, that sort of gentleness.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's my favourite sonic landscape. And I think that's the way that Eno thinks of the music that he makes as well. I saw a documentary about him, and it's almost as if he's a painter saying, so we've got this landscape I've sketched out here. Now we need something to go in the sky, some high notes here. And now I want to know about the creatures that inhabit this landscape, an event, a thump, a big echoing crash or something like that. So he's visualizing what these worlds will look like. And they're all, in my mind, slightly swampy sci-fi landscapes.
Adam Buxton, your first introduction to TV was, I think, presenting a programme called Takeover TV.
Yes. I remember seeing an advert saying, wanted quirky, interesting, funny home videos for new Channel 4 show Box Pops. And so I sent in some of my art college pieces, including one which was a music video about a performance artist called Randy Tart. The song was me singing over a Velvet Underground instrumental. Sent it in and was amazed to hear back. Dad said, oh, you got a call from a guy called Fenton Bailey. He's a TV producer, and he wants you to call him about the tape you sent in. That's still the most exciting message I ever got. That's the only time that ever happened.
And so how did you become involved from there on?
So I went in and met Fenton Bailey in the offices of World of Wonder opposite the Body Shop in Brixton. Fenton was very effusive, kept on using the word genius about my tape. I thought it was genius. I was like, oh my, he thinks I'm a genius. But then a runner came in and gave him his coffee, and he's like, oh, genius coffee. Excellent. Thank you. So I realized that everything was genius as far as Fenton was concerned. But still, I ended up getting a job as a researcher on this show, Takeover TV, presenting a couple of the shows.
And Joe Cornish joined you.
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think it got ratings sort of in the millions, which is hard to imagine nowadays.
Well, there are other people like Graham Norton, Alexander Armstrong and the filmmaker Edgar Wright. Quite an interesting group of people.
Lots of people were sending stuff in, mainly kind of male nerd men. It was doing Takeover TV that made us do recreations of movies with toys for the first time. We did a recreation of Apollo 13, the Tom Hanks movie. We also did a skit with my old Star Wars toys that my mum had saved and got down from the attic. And they went down really well. Channel 4 were very impressed. And I think those were partly responsible for getting us the commission for the Adam and Joe show in the end.
The next music is by that wonderful pianist, Thelonious Monk.
Yeah, now, Thelonious Monk is someone that I know, again, through my son. He reminds me, in comedic terms, of people that I love, like Vic and Bob, who are good at comedy, but they're mixing it with something different and they're deliberately turning things upside down and wrong-footing your expectations. Thank you.
great No Chaser, composed and performed by Thelonious Monk. I think your dad also had a segment on the Adam and Joe show as Bad Dad.
That's right. Louis Theroux was responsible for that. We used to have a routine every Christmas Eve. We'd have a drink with my parents, and then me and Joe and Louis would go out and carouse. My dad loved it because he was impressed by Louis. You know, Louis was always an impressive figure. He was a year younger than us, but he had been accelerated into our year at school, and he was cleverer than all of us. He knew about history and all these things that my dad cared about. All me and Joe knew about was movies. So basically, my dad would more or less monologue at Louis, and they'd drink lots of champagne, and me and Joe would pull faces behind my dad's back and try and make Louis laugh. And I always remember Louis saying, you know, your dad's a cool guy, he's an interesting guy. You should get him on your show. He could come on and maybe review gangster rap, was Louis' idea. And so that's what we did in the end. And it wasn't just gangster rap. He would review all sorts of different genres on the show, and he didn't like any of it.
What sort of thing did he say?
He thought it was barbaric. I remember him watching the video for Song 2 by Blur. Woo-hoo! And I feel heavy metal! Woo-hoo! He just couldn't get his head round, why does he want to feel heavy metal? What is that about? And there's a line in that song, I got my head shaved by a jumbo jet. And my dad was like, he's bragging about getting his head shaved by a jumbo jet. He seems to feel that it's very daring to be in this place where a huge heavy plane is flying where it ought not to be, so that it very nearly shaves his head. But so what? It just seems to me a celebration of ugliness, a celebration of violence. And I found out years later that my dad was a fan of a writer called Roger Scruton.
Ah.
Conservative philosopher, I suppose you could describe him as.
Very keen on Wagner.
Yeah, there you go. And Roger Scruton did a piece for Radio 4, in fact, that was called The Tyranny of Pop. It was so eerily similar to a lot of the opinions that my dad had. Yeah.
Your parents split up and your dad came to live with you in later life when he was dying of cancer. That must have been a very difficult as well as moving experience, because caring for somebody in that state is no joke.
No, it's not. But I suppose it was good because he was compos mentis, so that makes a big difference. I know that your father had dementia, right, towards the end of his life.
Yeah.
That's a whole other layer of complication and pain. I mean, if you don't mind me asking, like, was that an extended process for your dad? Was it many
years? Yes, it went on for several years. And the awful thing was that he'd been the most private, dignified man. And at one point he was found walking around the West End with nothing on but his underpants on his head.
Right. And the cops sort of pick people up like that, yeah, and think that they're drunk, right, or whatever.
Yes.
That's a full-time job, caring for someone like that. Hmm. I certainly wish that I'd found a good carer for my dad. But, you know, I liked having him at home and I was pleased that he wanted to be with us. But I think the reality of what it was going to be like and the service that he could expect from Castle Buckles was not what he wanted. And he got, like, initially he was very grateful and happy to be there in the bosom of our family with his grandchildren. But then the reality of the situation dawned on him, and he, you know, it's no fun being ill. And he got frustrated and I got frustrated with him, and it was painful in all those ways you don't really expect. I think I'd imagined basically that we would suddenly bond in a way that we never had previous to that. We'd always had quite a formal relationship, and he'd never been someone that wanted to talk about his feelings or anything like that, which I suppose was common for that war generation. You know, they didn't really discuss those sorts of things and thought they were better not discussed, in fact. And I've always been the opposite. So it was difficult. And we never had a moment of total bonding, not the kind of thing I was hoping for anyway.
Although just at the very end, there was a very touching moment when he suddenly kissed your hand, wasn't there?
Yeah, that was on the very last day of his life, in fact. He was staring off into the distance, kind of coming in and out of consciousness and lucidity. And I'd been trying to read to him from his Patrick O'Brien Master and Commander naval fiction books that he adored. He was getting a bit frustrated with me because I was not reading them as well as I should have done, and I mispronounced the name of the protagonist. And he pushed the book out of my hand because he was so fed up with how much I was murdering Patrick O'Brien. But then totally unexpectedly, he just sort of reached over and took my hand and gave it a kiss. And that was not something he had ever done before. So yes, you're always looking out in those times for just tiny moments of connection, I suppose, rather than the Hollywood version of sitting there and bearing your soul.
You found a stack of letters after he died, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, he left so many things behind. He was, like me, a bit of a hoarder. And so he'd filed away lots of letters and documents in manila envelopes, and he would put on the front, "Of interest to anyone should they come to write the story of my life," and then there would be subsection, "Financial crisis."
One letter was to David Cornwell. John le Carré.
Yes, his old friend from Oxford. He was so thrilled that he had been friends with John le Carré. He loved his book so much. He had all of them. And it meant so much to him that someone as talented as that had been part of his life once. And then he found himself in the position of being so strapped for cash that he felt he had no alternative but to write begging letters, really, asking for quite a lot of money to get him out of debt, having sent his children to expensive schools. And John le Carré wrote back a refusal, really. Well, not really, it was a refusal. It was like, "No, I'm sorry, I can't. But good luck and everything." It was as nice a letter as you could hope for in that situation. But my dad had kept it. And I just thought, what a weird thing to keep. It must have been so painful in the first place to write the letter, to beg a friend, and then to receive a rejection. That must have crushed him for practical reasons. And then the idea that you would file that away and think, "Yeah, that's a good one, let's keep that." I would burn that one.
So that must have been quite hard for you reading that, actually, because, as you say, the word humiliation comes to mind.
It was hard, but on the other hand, it was a funny moment of connection with Dad, because there it was, filed away in an envelope with an instruction to use it. And I put it in the book.
Ramblings.
Yeah, I put it in Ramble Book.
John Barry next.
This was one of the first things I ever heard of his. And it was for a Disney film called The Black Hole. Dad, as a travel writer and a lover of all things American, wrote about Disneyland a few times. And he loved taking us there. And we were lucky enough to go and visit when few British people were able to afford to do so. And we also got a preview screening of this new sci-fi film, The Black Hole, which is about a spaceship hovering around a black hole that's been missing for many years and is found by this other crew of explorers. It's quite weird and scary and almost horrific, but it starts with this amazing theme, this fantastic hook. It's kind of vertiginously queasy and alarming. It's like you're being sucked into the black hole and time is bending. It's amazing.
Thank you. Zero Gravity from The Black Hole, composed by John Barry. You met your wife Sarah in 2001, Adam, and you have three children together, moved to Norfolk. Sarah's clearly been an influence on you and appears in the podcasts even.
Yeah, she sort of appears in spectral form as a character who pops up every now and again, mainly in the form of arguments. I keep a log, which I think is quite useful because then you can refer back, see who won what. You don't want to cover old ground.
Potentially annoying too.
It's been pointed out that it could be seen as petty and tyrannical. But I strongly disagree. I think it's very useful. Ultimately, it leads to harmony in the house because I'm able to point at an actual log that says, look, we covered this before and I won that time. So why do you want to go over it again? But no, she's very nice about my stuff, my wife.
Another piece now, which your son Nat plays on the piano, I think.
Yes, so this is by Johnny Greenwood, who is one of the members of Radiohead. In 2007, myself and my friend Garth Jennings, who is a music video supremo, helped them record a few things, videos that were used as the official promos for In Rainbows. Jigsaw Falling Into Place and another track called Nude. And it was an amazing experience getting to see them at close quarters playing. And I just think that this is everything I love about Johnny Greenwood's music and Radiohead's music actually as well, which is that on the one hand, it's very accessible and tuneful, but then there are little things, again, that kind of upend it and wrong-foot it and little avant-garde flourishes. And my son can play this one. I got home another time and he was playing this and I just was so emotional to hear it.
Thank you. Johnny Greenwood's House of Woodcock from the film Phantom Thread, performed by the London Contemporary Orchestra, conducted by Robert Ames. You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest this week is the writer, comedian and podcaster Adam Buxton. The Adam and Joe show came to an end after three series, and you then had a radio show with Joe on XFM and then Six Music. Was there something about the medium of radio that you particularly loved?
Yes. The main thing I love about the sound-only world is that you can edit it and you can shape it in a way that takes a bit less time than it would for something visual. Live radio I find tricky. I get nervous, and at XFM, I did not enjoy myself a lot of the time because I just felt tongue-tied and anxious. And also you could see messages coming in from people on the computer, and a lot of them were abusive, as I recall. But I really preferred the world of podcasting, where I felt you could sort of invite people in who wanted to be there. And we started doing a podcast back in 2006 when very few people were doing them. And for me, it was some of the most fun I had with Joe, just being silly and laughing.
You were obviously very close, but there were disagreements, which you've written about quite honestly.
Yeah. Well, I transcribed one of the rows that me and Joe had at XFM after we'd got a particularly florid bit of abuse from one of the listeners. And Joe read it out to me in between tracks. And I snapped because he'd done this before, and I just really didn't like hearing about them. I didn't want that criticism in my head. And we ended up having a big row about to what extent should we be listening to what our listeners think of us. And it got to the point where Joe wanted to leave, and our producer calmed us down. But I was really rattled by it and went home and transcribed the confrontation. I think to try and get more of a perspective on to what extent was this my fault. And I came to the conclusion that it was quite a lot of my fault, and I had massively overreacted.
Well, I didn't tell you that some of this is live, and we've had some nice...
Why the hell have you got this guy on?
Joe started co-writing and directing his own films, Attack the Block, Ant-Man, Adventures of Tintin. So that must have been quite difficult for you at the time.
It was, yeah, because that was the basis of our whole relationship when we got to be friends in our early teens, was we were going to make films together. We were going to have this media empire. And then it just didn't really work out. We sort of got sidetracked into TV. And then when Joe went off and actually realised those filmmaking ambitions, and I realised that I couldn't properly do much to help him. We tried writing a couple of film ideas, but it just never really happened. That wasn't my strength. So it was painful to come to terms with that and watch him going off and having great success doing it. Having to admit, like, oh yeah, Attack the Block is great, but I wish I'd done it with you, you know. But again, podcasting came to my rescue, and I found something that I really loved doing and found an audience with it. And that in itself has opened up so many doors.
Is your friendship in a better place now?
Oh yeah, definitely.
We want to have a happy ending. This next music is from a film about Jackie Onassis,
which I haven't seen. It had a score by Mika Levy. I knew Mika's work through the Jonathan Glazer film, Under the Skin. The music was a big part of what made that film so extraordinary and scary. So then I sought out more of Mika's work and found this track called Vanity.
Vanity, composed and performed by Mika Levy, from the film score of Jackie. Adam Buxton, the rise of the internet and the explosion of online content has obviously been through a massive change during your and my lifetime, and you incorporate that into your touring show Bug.
Bug started in 2007 as a showcase for music videos, and hoping to get back to do more Bug shows next year, in fact. And we turned it into a TV show which incorporated a lot of my favourite music videos, things like the amazing Aardman animated video for Peter Gabriel's Sledgehammer, the video for Ashes to Ashes, David Bowie, and in a way like a perfect art form, so concise and inventive. But the other aspect of it I really liked was reading out ridiculous YouTube comments.
We're going to hear the Kyrie from the Fourier Requiem next. What led you to this?
I heard this at a memorial service for a friend of my family, and at those kinds of occasions, when you hear an extraordinary piece of music, it makes a particularly deep impression because you're emotional anyway. But then anything with choirs and something strange and complex going on with human voices gets to me.
Thank you. The Kyrie from the Fauré Requiem, performed by the 16, and the Academy of St Martin in the Fields Orchestra, conducted by Harry Christophers. Adam Buxton, your most recent book, I Love You, Bailly, talks about your relationship with your mum. She too came to live with you to recuperate, in her case, from a cancer treatment in 2020, but then died very suddenly 3 days later, which must have been awful, given you'd thought she was on the way to getting better.
Yeah, it was a shock. And I think it was because of the lockdown, really, because there was a tumour on her skull that she'd been getting chemo for leading up to 2020. And then I was worried about her in the lockdown and called her up a few times and said, like, how's it going? And she'd be, I'm fine, all fine. She lived out near Reading and she'd go for walks by the river and she liked it down there, you know, tending to her garden and being part of the community there. And then it was around the time that first wave of anxiety about who was sticking to the lockdown rules and who was breaking them was in the air. So I was keenly aware of feeling that the rules should be stuck to unless it was an emergency. And my mum was insisting that it wasn't an emergency, but actually it was. And I got a call from someone in the local Waitrose who said, I'm here with your mum and she's in a bad way and I think you should come and fetch her. So I went to go and get her, but she was in a really bad way and took her to a hospital in Norwich, hoping that they would sort her out. But no, she died a few days afterwards.
And you discovered some things about her that you hadn't known.
After she died, because I couldn't go and sort through her belongings down in Reading, really. So I just arranged for a company to pack everything up and bring them to my house to add to our giant teetering pile of crap that we already had accumulated, and then spent the next few months going through it all dutifully, thinking, well, I can't just throw this stuff out. This is mum, you know. And I was consumed by grief and I missed her. So in a way, it was comforting to go through it all. But in another way, it was very painful. And you always find bits and pieces that just deepen that grief. And one of them was letters from some bloke that I didn't know was part of her life. And then I kind of pieced together this relationship that she had never told me and my brother and sister about, presumably because she was embarrassed or didn't feel it was appropriate or something, even though we would have been totally fine with it. And then sort of at the bottom of this stack of correspondence, finding the obituary of this person and realising that he had died at a point where she had taken a dive mentally and physically as well. I just felt awful that I hadn't really been around to be of comfort to her and cheer her up. But her whole philosophy was like, keep calm and carry on and don't bother people with it, you know.
Would you urge people to ask questions where they probably shrink from doing it at the moment, just to sort of open up?
I would definitely say if you have parents who are still around and you have enough of a relationship that you could suggest to them that you sit down and talk about their lives and, you know, tell me some stories from before you had kids and fill in the gaps a little bit. And I wish I'd done those things with my mum.
Music from Bulgaria next.
Yes. My introduction to this piece of music was David Byrne of Talking Heads.
Yeah.
And he did an album called Music for the Knee Plays. And one of the tracks played by a brass band was called Theodora is Dozing, I think. And it turns out that it was this arrangement of a track by a Bulgarian choir who had been recorded in the 70s and then reissued by 4AD, this kind of trendy indie label, in the mid-80s, and became hugely influential for a whole bunch of musicians.
Sino vamos
Polignala e Todora, the Bulgarian State Radio and Television Female Vocal Choir, conducted by Philip Kutev. Adam Buxton, you launched, as you said, the Adam Buxton podcast in September 2015. Each episode starts with you musing about your life on a walk with your dog, Rosie. What kind of dog is Rosie?
Rosie is a Whippet Poodle Cross and 13 years old now, so she's getting on a little bit. I thought you were going to say that my podcast starts with a self-composed theme tune, the same way that this one does.
Well, actually, it was taken from music from Chaucer.
Yeah.
And I always loved it because the translation had the line, "Vile brass emanating from the devil's arse."
Oh, yeah, that's good. I've got nothing that fancy in my one. All I've got is, "My name is Adam Buxton, I'm a man. I want you to enjoy this, that's the plan."
Well, I think that tops mine by a long way.
I don't know, about brass from the arse of the devil. Come on.
You enjoy your podcasting, clearly. I mean, it wouldn't work if you didn't, I don't think.
Yeah, well, it's an exercise in trying to form connections, I suppose, and the joy that you get when that works. Sometimes people say to me, "Oh, it's weird meeting you because your voice is so familiar. I listen to your podcast and I feel like I'm your friend, but I'm not your friend. I don't know you." And I say, "You do know me. You've probably spent more time with me than lots of people. You know lots about me because I'm always wanging on about my life on my podcast." So we are friends in a way.
You took part rather memorably in Bake Off recently, didn't you?
Oh, yes. It was a bit painful for me, though, because I was convinced I was going to win. I had an idea for the final round, the Showstopper Challenge, to create a tribute to a celebrity. My first thought was maybe something Bowie-related, but then I thought, oh, no, I'm always going on about Bowie. And then I had this idea to make a cherry pie tribute to my favourite film, which is Alien, the Ridley Scott film, with a pastry xenomorph bursting from the centre, the little baby alien that bursts out of John Hurt's chest in the movie. And I practiced at home and I experimented with all kinds of different ways of making the pastry alien. But the problem was, once you get it in the oven, all the pastry would sag and fall off. But then I figured out, if you built it round a unripe banana, I bet you didn't think you're going to be having this conversation this morning, did you? Then it would stand upright in the pie. And I baked one and it was beautiful. I thought, oh my God, I'm going to win Bake Off. This is amazing. I'm going to get respect. Doors are going to open. I'm going to be on Taskmaster. My children will respect me. But then, spoiler, on the day, it didn't work out like that. And I think I blame Bake Off for giving me the wrong kind of bananas. At some point, I got back from using the toilet outside the Bake Off tent, and the camera crew, the story crew, were standing by the oven and beckoning me over with excited grins on their faces and saying, "Look what's happening in the oven, Adam." And I looked in to find my alien lying on the floor of the oven, bubbling away. "How do you feel about that, Adam?" And how I felt was I wanted to cry. But I thought, keep it together, Buckles. You're 55.
You're going to end with a piece I absolutely adore. Why do you love it?
So this is Daphnis and Chloe. I also happen to know that this is by someone who knew your dad, right? Maurice Ravel.
Yes, he helped my father, took him to Paris to study with Nadia Boulanger.
Yep. Yeah, this is another one that my son introduced me to. And every now and again, we'll stand around in the kitchen and play music to each other and go, "Have you heard this? What do you think of that?" And this was one he played me. And he said, "I think this is the best piece of music I've ever heard." I feel quite emotional saying it, because those moments of musical connection mean more to me than anything, I think. And so we sat round and listened to this. And looking at his face, sort of looking at me in that way that you do when you're playing a piece of music that you love to someone, going, "What do you think? What do you think?" And I didn't expect it to be so straightforwardly romantic, but I loved it. And I said, "Yeah, I get it." There was a production of it at the Royal Festival Hall, and we went along to see it. And he'd never seen a live orchestra before. But again, the thing that made a huge impression on me was the giant choir. doing this otherworldly stuff on top of this beautiful music.
Yes, they have a wordless chorus, in fact.
Yeah.
So it's like voice from another sphere.
Right. And again, really reminded me of sci-fi music.
Well, thank you very much, Adam Buxton. It's been a great pleasure. And let's hear Ravel's wonderful Daphnis and Chloe.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. It's been really an honour to be here, Michael.
Part 1 of Daphnis et Chloé by Maurice Ravel, performed by the Bordeaux Opera Chorus and the Bordeaux Aquitaine National Orchestra, conducted by Laurent Petit-Girard, the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions, the comedian, writer and podcaster Adam Buxton. The programme was produced by Claire Walker, and next week Michael's talking to the singer-songwriter Neil Hannon.
BBC Radio 3, the home of classical music.
Composer of the Week, Ludwig van Beethoven. Join me, Donald MacLeod, as I explore his ever-changing relationship with his nephew, Carl. The fight to be his legal guardian, and the resistance from Carl's mother, Johanna. Uncover the tempestuous family drama behind the music. Composer of the Week, Beethoven, starts tomorrow afternoon from 4.
Listen on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
Good afternoon from me, Chris Berrow. Now on Radio 3 at 1:30, it's Music Map with Sarah Moore-Peach.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map, where a single piece of music sets us off on a path of discovery as we wend our way towards it through a landscape of connected sounds. And today's landscape is one of mountains and palm trees, hot and humid, cooled by the trade winds that come off the Atlantic. We are off to the city of Rio de Janeiro, the home of Brazilian composer Heitor Villa-Lobos, famous for his Bachianas Brasileiras. Today's musical destination is the fifth of Villa-Lobos' Bachianas Brasileiras, blending Brazil and Bach, and scored, unusually, for 8 cellos and a solo singer. So let's begin today with Bach and just one cello.